Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, we hear a segment of another What It Takes podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. We also listen to the American story to Thanksgiving Day Gentlemen by O. Henry. And we hear from reporter Susan Shand. But first, Ashley Thompson and I tell you about a new movie. In the new movie, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and Everywhere Else, Frances McDormand means business. McDormand plays Mildred Hayes, a woman filled with anger over the unsolved rape and murder of her daughter. She begins a noisy public campaign to hold the town's sheriff responsible for not finding the killer. Mildred puts up billboards near the sleepy Missouri town where they live. The sign's messages insult the sheriff and demand action. In some ways, it is hard to separate the character of Mildred from the equally uncompromising McDormand. In the film, Mildred is a strong and determined force because McDormand is one, too. Mildred seems like the heroine we need in real life, at this moment especially. The darkly humorous and violent spirit of outrage in Three Billboards has touched a nerve with moviegoers, perhaps more than any other film this fall.
The movie opened in New York and Los Angeles last weekend. It also showed at the 2017 Venice Film Festival, where it won the award for movie writing. Three Billboards also won the Audience Award at the Toronto International Film Festival in Canada. The movie's director, Martin McDonagh, talked about the timing of the movie. "It's great to be putting out a film with such a strong woman lead character," he said. "Even just 2 months ago, before anyone had seen it, I wasn't sure how it was going to be taken. We thought it was a good film with great performances, but we worried that the darkness in the story might not allow people to laugh," he said. The Irish playwright and filmmaker wrote the part for McDormand after meeting her at a party several years ago. He praised McDormand for her film work and as a person. He said she is not towing the Hollywood line and not doing what's expected of her.
Her Three Billboards co-star, Sam Rockwell, agrees. "She has to do it a certain way. It's part of who she is, and it's part of who Mildred is. There's something burning in her, just like those billboards. There's something burning in Frances," he said. The performance places McDormand in an early lead for an Academy Award next year. She won a Best Actress Oscar for her 1997 performance in Fargo. She has been nominated for three other Academy Awards as well. Anita Katz of the San Francisco Examiner called McDormand's Mildred a raging force of purpose with a caring heart. McDormand says what moves her these days is a strong, renewed interest in work, now that her son has reached adulthood. McDormand, who is 60 years old, says the chance to play a protagonist was a gift at her age. In her words, "I was ready for it." She says she seeks women characters who, in her words, stand on their own in the dramatic arc of the storytelling.
The movie also has an excellent performance by Rockwell. In his character's story and others, Mildred's campaign unsettles the established order. "It's timely," Rockwell says of the film. "It's speaking to a lot of things that are going on in this country. It's talking about racism and misogyny. Ultimately, I think it's about love and redemption. But I think it has a lot of anger in it, a healthy amount of anger." McDormand herself does not exactly share Mildred's rage, but she does connect with the film's demand for truthful discussions of issues and change. Like everything in our culture, the more women that wield power, the more stories will be told, says McDormand. She says America lags behind the international landscape of women being in power. So, she says, it's time for us to catch up.
Now we have more movie news from reporter Susan Shand.
The Weinstein Company planned to release its new film, The Current War, in the United States this week. But the opening has been delayed until next year. Disgraced film producer Harvey Weinstein heads the company, and he is accused of sexually harassing and assaulting several women in Hollywood. The film stars Oscar nominee Benedict Cumberbatch. He plays lightbulb inventor Thomas Edison, who clashes with industrialist George Westinghouse in the early 20th century. Edison prefers direct electrical current, while Westinghouse, played by Michael Shannon, wants to use the more dangerous alternating current. Originally, the two men wanted to work together, but Edison received a lot of investment money from the world's richest man, J.P. Morgan, and decided to work alone. Westinghouse and Edison became enemies, fighting over the future of electricity. Benedict Cumberbatch says that he played the role of Edison because it was a great challenge.
"That's kind of an exciting chapter of history, no matter who you're playing in it. And I just thought, you know, it's a challenge to play such a totemic figure in American culture. And I like a challenge."
Michael Shannon says he tried to play Westinghouse as a complex character and not let him become a great egoist.
"For every success they had a failure, you know, and it wasn't always easy."
In addition to Edison and Westinghouse, the film features the life of Nikola Tesla, assistant to Edison, who goes on to work for Westinghouse. Actor Nicholas Holt plays Tesla. Holt says that Tesla believed that everyone had a right to use electrical power, and it would change the world dramatically. As a character, he adds, Tesla is interesting to play because he was often poor, but was always well-dressed. Director Alfonso Gomez-Rejon has received some criticism for his use of special effects and odd camera angles. He says he wanted the audience to understand the importance of electricity and the way it would change the world. He says he had to tell a long story in a short time, and he hopes it captures the feeling of the time. I'm Susan Shand.
Next up is What It Takes, a podcast of interviews from the American Academy of Achievement. Andrew Young is the subject today. Here, he talks about the development of his belief in nonviolent resistance. To hear the whole podcast, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
We had been shopping in Albany, Georgia, and we were driving back, Gene and me, with a three-month-old baby and a bassinet in the back seat of this little Nash Rambler. And we go around the curve in this little town called Don't Run, Georgia. And I was going pretty fast, and there were people all over the streets, you know? And I slowed down quickly, and there must have been 100 people in sheets with their pointed hats. They didn't have their face masks on, but I turned the corner and I was in the middle of a Klan rally. And I realized that they were coming to Thomasville because I had put up signs about a voter registration drive. And I was prepared for it, you know? And so I said to Jean, I said, look, she's a country girl. One of the things we used to do on dates is go out in the backyard and shoot tin cans. So she was a good shot. I said, look, I'm going to try to reason with these people if they come to visit us. And I want you to sit in the window and just point our rifle at the guy I'm talking to. And see, I'd been to theology school, and I grew up in the Second World War, where Reinhold Niebuhr and others criticized the church for being pacifist. So I said, you point the gun at him, and then I can reason with him as a brother. Because if he takes me out, you take him out. And she said, I'm not going to do that. I said, what do you mean? What are you going to do? She said, I'm not going to point a gun at a human being. I said, that's not a human being. That's the Ku Klux Klan. She said, look, don't you forget it. Under that sheet is the heart of a child of God. And my idea was, damn, woman. what kind of woman did I marry? And she said, no, we're not going to point guns. We're not. She said, if you don't believe in what you preach, we need to quit now.
Andrew Young took in her words and took a different tact. He got out of the way of the Klan, got home, and found a local business leader willing to accompany him to visit the mayor, who also happened to run the town's hardware store. The mayor then called the head of the two biggest employers in town, and together they made an agreement that the Klan could convene on the courthouse steps, but would not enter the black community or disrupt their registration drive.
That was my first test of nonviolence. What it taught me was that the best way to avoid violence is to head it off. Not wait for a confrontation where violence is almost inevitable, but that you've got to be more aggressive pursuing what Gandhi called organized, aggressive, disciplined goodwill.
And what gave Andrew Young the idea that he could possibly broker a deal with the Klan? Well, as I said earlier, I've started his story in the middle. But now I'll go back to Andrew Young's beginnings, because as he tells it, he started learning his ambassadorial skills at his father's knee.
Because I grew up in New Orleans, and there was an Irish grocery store on one corner, an Italian bar on another corner, and the Nazi Party headquarters was on the third corner. My aunt lived right behind the Nazi Party, and there was no air conditioning, so The windows were opening, and my father had to explain to me why these people were hailing Hitler. And he did a very interesting thing. He took me to the movies to see the 1936 Olympics and Jesse Owens. And when Jesse Owens won his first race, Hitler got up and walked out. He said, "You see, racism is a sickness," my father said. And said, "Jesse didn't get mad. He just went on and won 3 more gold medals." And he said, the thing you need to remember is that you don't get mad with sick people. You help them. And you can't help them unless you try to understand them. So even as a 4 or 5-year-old, he was trying to make me responsible for understanding racism. He didn't expect it to change. But he wanted me to be able to survive and thrive. And he used to say all the time, "You're in a struggle. But if you get in a fight and lose your temper, you lose the fight. So don't get mad, get smart."
Young's dad did also get him boxing lessons, however, on the theory that if you know how to fight, you don't have to fight. Young says everything his father taught him helped him to survive in his mixed neighborhood.
And then because it was segregated, I had to go out of that neighborhood to another neighborhood where I was the little rich kid whose parents had been to college, and so I had to deal with poverty and how to accept privilege as a responsibility and not as a burden.
And now it is time for an American story.
Two Thanksgiving Day Gentlemen. There is one day that is ours. There is one day when all Americans go back to the old home and eat a big dinner. Bless the day. The president gives it to us every year. Sometimes he talks about the people who had the first Thanksgiving. They were the Puritans. They were some people who landed on our Atlantic shore. We really don't remember much about them. But those people ate a large bird called turkey on the first Thanksgiving day. So we have turkey for Thanksgiving dinner, if we have enough money to buy a turkey. That is a tradition. Yes, Thanksgiving Day is the one day of the year that is purely American. And now here's the story to prove to you that we have old traditions in this new country. They are growing older more quickly than traditions in old countries. That is because we are so young and full of life. We do everything quickly. Stuffy Pete sat down on a seat in the New York City park named Union Square. It was the third seat to the right as you enter Union Square from the east. Every Thanksgiving Day for 9 years, he had sat down there at 1 p.m. Every time, things had happened to him. They were wonderful things. They made his heart feel full of joy. And they filled another part of him, too. They filled the part below his heart. On those other Thanksgiving days, he had been hungry. It is a strange thing. There are rich people who wish to help the poor, but many of them seem to think that the poor are hungry only on Thanksgiving Day. But today, Pete was not hungry. He had come from a dinner so big that he had almost no power to move. His light green eyes looked out from a gray face on which there was still a little food. His breath was short. His body had suddenly become too big for his clothes. It seemed ready to break out of them. They were torn. You could see his skin through a hole in the front of his shirt. But the cold wind with snow in it felt pleasantly cool to him. For Stuffy Pete was overheated with the warmth of all he had had to eat. The dinner had been much too big. It seemed to him that his dinner had included all the turkey and all the other food in the whole world. So he sat, very, very full. He looked out at the world without interest, as if it could never offer him anything more. The dinner had not been expected. He had been passing a large house near the beginning of that great broad street called Fifth Avenue. It was the home of two ladies of an old family. These two old ladies had a deep love of traditions. There were certain things they always did. On Thanksgiving Day at noon, they always sent a servant to stand at the door. There he waited for the first hungry person to walk by. The servant had orders to bring that person into the house and feed him until he could eat no more. Stuffy Pete happened to pass by on his way to the park. The servant had gathered him in. Tradition had been followed. Stuffy Pete sat in the park looking straight before him for 10 minutes. Then he felt a desire to look in another direction. With a very great effort, he moved his head slowly to the left. Then his eyes grew wider and his breath stopped. His feet in their torn shoes at the ends of his short legs moved about on the ground. For the old gentleman was coming across Fourth Avenue toward Stuffy's seat. Every Thanksgiving for 9 years, the old gentleman had come there to find Stuffy Pete on his seat. That was a thing that the old gentleman was trying to make into a tradition. Every Thanksgiving Day for 9 years, he had found Stuffy there. Then he had led Stuffy to a restaurant and watched him eat a big dinner. They do these things more easily in old countries like England. They do them without thinking about them. But in this young country, we must think about them. In order to build a tradition, we must do the same thing again and again for a long time. The old gentleman loved his country. He believed he was helping to build a great American tradition. And he had been doing very well. 9 years is a long time here. The old gentleman moved straight and proud toward the tradition that he was building. Truly, feeding Stuffy Pete once a year was not a very important tradition. There are greater and more important traditions in England. But it was a beginning. It proved that a tradition was at least possible in America. The old gentleman was thin and tall and 60. He was dressed all in black. He wore eyeglasses. His hair was whiter and thinner than it had been last year. His legs did not seem as strong as they had seemed the year before. As this kind old gentleman came toward him, Stuffy began to shake and his breath was shorter. He wished he could fly away, but he could not move from his seat. "Good morning," said the old gentleman. "I am glad to see that the troubles of another year have not hurt you. You continue to move in health about the beautiful world. For that blessing, you and I can give thanks on this day of Thanksgiving. If you will come with me, my man, I will give you a dinner that will surely make your body feel as thankful as your mind." That is what the old gentleman said every time, every Thanksgiving Day, for 9 years. The words themselves were almost a tradition. Always before, they had been music in Stuffy's ear. But now he looked up at the old gentleman's face with tears of suffering in his eyes. The snow turned quickly to water when it fell upon his hot face. But the old gentleman was shaking with the cold. He turned away with his back to the wind, and he did not see Stuffy's eyes. Stuffy had always wondered why the old gentleman seemed sad as he spoke. He did not know that it was because the old gentleman was wishing that he had a son. A son would come there after he himself was gone. A son would stand proud and strong before Stuffy and say, "In remembrance of my father," then it would really be a tradition. But the old gentleman had no family. He lived in a room in one of the old houses near the park. In the winter, he grew a few flowers there. In the spring, he walked on Fifth Avenue. In the summer, he lived in a farmhouse in the hills outside New York. And he talked of a strange bug he hoped someday to find. In the fall season, he gave Stuffy a dinner. These were the things that filled the old gentleman's life. Stuffy Pete looked up at him for half a minute, helpless and very sorry for himself. The old gentleman's eyes were bright with the giving pleasure. His face was getting older every year, but his clothes were very clean and fresh. And then Stuffy made a strange noise. He was trying to speak, as the old gentleman had heard the noise 9 times before. He understood it. He knew that Stuffy was accepting.
"Thank you. I'm very hungry."
Stuffy was very full. But he understood that he was part of a tradition. His desire for food on Thanksgiving Day was not his own. It belonged to this kind old gentleman. True, America is free, but there are some things that must be done. The old gentleman led Stuffy to the restaurant and to the same table where they had always gone. They were known there.
"Here comes that old man," said a waiter. "It buys the old no-good fella a dinner every Thanksgiving."
The old gentleman sat at the table watching. The waiters brought food and more food, and Stuffy began to eat. No great and famous soldier ever battled more strongly against an enemy. The turkey and all the other food were gone almost as quickly as they appeared. Stuffy saw the look of happiness on the old gentleman's face. He continued to eat in order to keep it there. In an hour, the battle was finished.
"Thank you," Stuffy said. "Thank you for my Thanksgiving dinner."
Then he stood up heavily and started to go to the wrong door. A waiter turned him in the right direction. The old gentleman carefully counted out $1.30 and left 15 cents more for the waiter. They said goodbye, as they did each year, at the door. The old gentleman went south, and Stuffy went north. Stuffy went around the first corner and stood for 1 minute. Then he fell. There he was found. He was picked up and taken to a hospital. They put him on a bed and began to try to discover what strange sickness had made him fall. And an hour later, the old gentleman was brought to the same hospital. And they put him on another bed and began to try to discover what his sickness could be. After a little time, one of the doctors met another doctor, and they talked. "That nice old gentleman over there," he said, "do you know what's wrong with him? He's almost dead for the need of food. A very proud old man, I think. He told me he has had nothing to eat for 3 days."
That's all the time we have for today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you return too. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.